Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a conversation with a First Nations architect on how Indigenous culture informs her designs.
And how the Trump administration has transformed the role of humor in political discourse.
But first, Republicans and Democrats are pointing fingers at each other over a pair of budget situations that need immediate attention. The Department of Child Safety's Congregate Care Program is in danger of running out of money this coming Monday, while the Department of Economic Security Program for Residents with Disabilities is also running out of cash. And the fights over these programs could be a harbinger of budget battles to come when lawmakers and the governor get into the nitty-gritty of the budget for the next fiscal year, which starts on July 1st. Joining me now with the latest on all of this is Wayne Schutzke from KJZZ's Politics Desk. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So what are exactly these two programs that are short on cash right now?
So the first one, which I've talked about before on the show, is the DDD program, which is that program you mentioned for Arizonans with disabilities. It basically provides all the funding for the long-term care that they require, the caregivers, that kind of thing. And basically, it needs $122 million or else it will run out of money by May, is what the department is saying. A lot of reasons why that has happened, you know, costs that are above expectations, that kind of thing, and some fighting over whose fault that is. Republicans say the governor for continuing some programs that they didn't provide funding for. The other one is, as you mentioned, DCS, Department of Child Safety, their congregate care program. So that's children who are, you know, wards of the state and are in group homes specifically. The governor sent a letter to lawmakers a few weeks ago basically saying they need money by next week, or $6.5 million, or else that program is also going to run out of money.
So as we've talked about, Republicans and Democrats are not in agreement on what to do about this. So let's start with the developmental disabilities, the DDD program, because that's been going on in the public eye, at least, for maybe a little bit longer. This is one where the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, David Livingston, was on the show a few weeks back and said, we're not going to do what's called a supplemental appropriation for this. We're not going to add money now. This will just have to be part of the next budget. But it doesn't seem like the legislature is all that close with the governor on getting that done.
That's correct. Yeah. Democrats keep saying, hey, let's just take care of this problem now. And they've tried multiple times different procedural maneuvers to kind of force through a bill that would give that supplemental, as you called it, which is basically just a clean, here's the $122 million you say you need, new money to the budget to pay for these programs.
In the current fiscal year.
In the current fiscal year, yeah. So to give them that money to finish out this year, and then we can hash out what we do next year in the next budget. Republicans say, whoa, this is structural. This is ongoing. So this should be part of discussions for the next budget as well, and we can fit that supplemental into that new budget. Because even though it's a budget for next year, they can include some of those supplementals to cover the rest of the cost for this year. The problem, as you mentioned, is budget negotiations in recent history have stretched all the way into June sometimes. Well, this division is going to run out of money in May, and so that's why the governor and Democrats are saying, no, let's take care of this now. But Republicans control the legislature, and they're saying, no, we want all of this done as one deal.
Is that the argument for the DCS, the Congregate Care Program, as well? The Republicans want that to be part of the overall budget for next year also?
No, that's a little bit different, and it is a bit of a different situation. They're actually holding a meeting today, a joint budget committee, so Republicans and Democrats and both sides of the legislature come together on this budget committee, and they're going to look at solutions to get that $6.5 million. It's a little bit different because the governor's not asking for new money here. She's actually proposed pulling the money from other funds within DCS that they already have that go towards kinship care, which is having family members take care of kids who are in foster care and foster home placements, saying that basically those two line items, for lack of a better word, are coming in under budget. So we have extra money. We haven't served enough kids that we've budgeted for. So let's pull it out of there, put it into congregate care. Now, Livingston, the chair of the Appropriations Committee, said, no, we're not taking money away from foster care. We're not taking money away from kinship care. We do want the governor to find places in her budget to pull this money from, but those are non-starters for us.
Interesting. So does it seem as though there's going to be some kind of solution before next week for the congregate care program?
I think for the DCS one, today's meeting will really show us where they're coming from. I think the Republicans are going to come up with some options where they think the governor can pull money from the budget. And then it's just kind of up to whether the governor agrees with that, because she basically has to request their approval to make those budget changes. But they can't do that in reverse. They can't, like, approve it without her requesting it, is how I understand the process works. I do think that problem will get solved, at least temporarily. It's $6.5 million, a lot of money for you or me, but in the scope of the larger budget, not as much. However, that only gets them through the end of April. So then we could be right back where we started if a budget isn't solved by then. End of April, also coincidentally, when DDD needs that funding. So Livingston has consistently said we could get a budget done by April if the governor would come to the table. But then the governor counters and says, I've made my budget public. You guys haven't. So why don't you do that? So it's kind of this back and forth of who's not coming to the table. Both sides say I'm willing to talk, but both sides blame the other side for not being willing to talk. So it's kind of a stalemate at the moment.
Yeah. Well, so, like, is there any way to sort of take what we're seeing right now and look ahead and say, okay, this is telling about how budget talks are going to go when they really get going?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, budget talks have taken a long time in recent memory, and this is indicative that this year is going to be no different, because if you think about it, the budget covers everything the state government does. These are two specific programs, and they can't even come to an agreement on that. And it's not like these are two specific programs that's just a problem this year. As I mentioned, all these costs are going to be needed next year as well. These are ongoing programs. So these fights they're having right now about how these programs should be run, where cuts need to be made potentially, are all going to be part of the discussions about next year's budget too. So if they can't agree today, then there's no promise that they might be able to agree tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, plenty to keep the politics desk busy over the next several weeks.
That's for sure.
That is KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the politics desk. Thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you.
A proposal that aims to protect students from sexual misconduct in schools is moving through the state legislature. The measure, known as Ava's Law, would essentially suspend immunity for school districts if a student is the victim of sexual abuse by an employee on whom the district did not complete a proper background check. That would also be the case if a statutory duty to report did not happen. Governor Hobbs vetoed a similar bill last year, but its main advocates are hopeful for getting a signature this year. The House Judiciary Committee unanimously approved the bill yesterday. There was no opposition when it cleared the state Senate either. With me to talk more about this issue is Cheryl Shakeshaft, Distinguished Professor of Educational Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of the book Organizational Betrayal: How Schools Enable Sexual Misconduct and How to Stop It. And Cheryl, how did you come to this issue of sexual misconduct happening in schools and people not necessarily knowing about it?
Well, it was decades ago when one of my doctoral students, who was also a full-time principal, came to me and said he thought that one of his teachers was having sex with students, and he wanted to know what he should do about it. And, you know, I honestly hadn't really much ever thought about it. And so he and I worked on it and talked about it and said he should call the police because it was a crime. These were underage students. And he did, and the person was arrested. But it got me thinking, you know, how big a problem is this? This was in the 1980s. And so how big a problem is this? What are schools doing about it if it's a problem? How does it happen? And because of that, I started doing a series of studies, and I have spent, you know, the last four decades, along with other work I do, studying school employee sexual misconduct.
Well, over those years, how prevalent have you found this to be?
Well, the most recent and reliable estimates are about 17% of students report that sometime in their K-12 career, they have been targeted by a school employee and have had a sexual interaction with a school employee. So I think that's about 9 million students at any one time.
That seems like an awfully high number.
It is. When I first started, we did some studies and it was about 9%. So it seems to be increasing rather than decreasing.
Any sense as to why that might be?
Well, it could be an artifact of the research because different methods have been used to ask these questions. It may depend upon the sample and how representative it is. Before that, it was about 10% of the most reliable, and that was data collected by the Department of Education, which I consider to be pretty reliable. So I would say between 10 and 17%.
Are there any particular demographic groups that are particularly at risk here?
Well, the kids who are at risk are vulnerable kids. So if the demographic that of vulnerable kids or kids who are more likely to be discriminated against or not believed is racial, then it might be that. Certainly kids with special needs are more likely to be targeted than kids who don't present with special needs. Females are more likely to be targeted than males. But really, just about every kind of kid can be targeted.
I would imagine that within the school, you mentioned, you know, a student of yours who is also a principal, you know, had a suspicion that there was something untoward going on. I would think that there must be some amount of hesitation on the part of teachers or other school employees to turn someone else in. I mean, that's a really big accusation. And if you're wrong, that seems like it would be a really big problem.
Well, that's what teachers say. If I'm wrong, it's a big problem. But you know what? If they're right and they don't report, it's a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Because it's the student who is being abused who isn't being protected. And it is one of the issues. In almost every case I've studied, and I've studied 300 cases from all around, and in every case, kids knew, and adults wouldn't say they knew, but they would say things like, I was very suspicious, or I thought it odd, or this isn't the way most people usually behave. So the adults had their concerns about the behavior of a colleague, and yet they didn't report. And when asked about that, they would say just what you said. Well, you know, if I'm wrong, I could really ruin someone's career. But what they don't say is, but if I'm right and I don't report, I could really ruin a kid's life.
Yeah.
Now, I would also argue that they won't ruin a person's career if they make an accusation that isn't accurate. Because when they report, first of all, they're not saying they know. They're saying this is something that needs to be investigated. That's it.
Well, so then in terms of trying to get more people who suspect there are bad things happening to report them, is that a policy change? Is it more of a culture change in schools, do you think?
I think it's a culture change. First of all, it's a training change. We need training. Mm. And we need training not just about what would consist of a boundary crossing, but the training needs to focus on the bystanders. So I think it's more of a culture change than anything else.
Have you seen any evidence to suggest that culture shift is happening in schools?
Seen it a little bit, but not a lot. No.
So understanding, as you say, that it's maybe more of a culture change than a policy change, I do want to ask you about a proposal moving through the state legislature here in Arizona that would seemingly incentivize schools and school districts maybe to do more robust background checks on employees. In the world of policy proposed changes, is that the kind of thing that you think could make a difference?
That is something that could make a difference. And I want to be even more specific in terms of talking about background checks. Very often when we use the term background checks, it's short for criminal background checks. So in nearly every school, they'll run a criminal background check. You know, has the person been convicted of a crime?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that gets at some people, but very few of those people actually apply for jobs in schools or actually apply for teacher positions. They may apply for jobs in schools. So background check needs to understand something a little broader than just the criminal background check. But nevertheless, they're important and they do identify people who've been convicted of a crime. But very often the person isn't convicted of a crime. So when we talk about background checks, we need to think of them as both criminal background checks and reference background checks. And by that I mean, I've studied how teachers and others are hired, and very often they don't really do a very useful reference background check. They don't necessarily call a person up who was the direct supervisor. They don't ask, why did the person leave this job? They don't ask, were there ever any complaints or allegations of misconduct towards students. Those questions are rarely asked. And those are the questions that in a reference or a background check would get to, yes, the person left because we didn't like how they interacted with students.
Cheryl Shakeshaft is a distinguished professor of educational leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University and author of the book Organizational Betrayal: How Schools Enable Sexual Misconduct and How to Stop It.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how Indigenous culture manifests itself in architectural designs.
And so I think part of the, the foundation of how we create design is that alignment with place, with sun, with climate, with the materials of a place, with the history of a place.
We'll hear from a First Nations architect about designs focused on human nature.
But first, on his Substack, The Choya Express, Billy Robb recently mused about the way President Trump, and increasingly his loyalists, use humor in official White House communications. The result, Robb wrote, is confounding for opponents of the president's agenda because it's hard to figure out when or if he's being serious. As Robb told me, he's concerned about this, not just as a political observer, but also because of his day job.
I'm a civics teacher by trade, and I take the constitutional order very seriously, and just been observing, for a long time, but especially the last few months, the sort of trollish nature of the Trump administration and the way they wage politics, and how it's kind of become people posting things like Trump 2028 and, posting memes of Trump dressed like a king and supposed to be joking, I think, because.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the interesting spaces that I think you're exploring here in this essay is, as you put it in the newsletter, you're supposed to be in on the joke, unless maybe it's serious, in which case I'm not sure, and neither are Trump's loyalists, as you write.
Yeah, I don't think some of them do, and that part stood out when about the Canada thing, right? Because after he got elected, he started talking about annexing Canada, why it should be the 51st state, and his own spokesperson is asked about it at a press conference and says, yes, Canada should be the 51st state, but she's kind of smiling.
Right.
And so
this is Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary you're talking about.
Yes. And so it's just very disconcerting and very both tiresome and worrying to me that this is all a big joke, especially because Canada is not in on the joke. The people of Canada and the politicians of Canada are taking it very seriously.
Well, this is the thing that I think you're hitting on here that feels like such an urgent question of this moment is who is in on the joke? And one of the things that you also point out in your piece that I thought was very interesting is it's not like humor is a new political tool. And you even cite people like Barry Goldwater. Tell us a little bit about why you feel like the way Barry Goldwater used humor is different than the way Trump and his emissaries do.
Well, yes. Like, I'm not trying to be a buzzkill. And I think humor is, brings life to, social groups. And it's been used very often in politics, whether it's satire, whether it's, telling jokes to relate to the audience. And a lot of Republicans have been excellent at that from Ronald Reagan and Goldwater back to Abraham Lincoln. But I see with Trump, it's a completely different thing in the sense of, and it probably has to do with who he was before he became a politician, which was, a reality TV show host and sort of an expert at getting attention.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you're bringing up something really critical there, Billy, which is in the example in your piece that you cite of Barry Goldwater, you're talking about how in the New York Times in 1964, he's, I guess, campaigning in Minnesota. And, you know, he's trying to make a connection with the locals. And he says, like, wow, you know, you guys got a lot of nice lakes here. And then he says, out where I come from, we have so little water that the trees chase the dogs, which is, you know, it's a great line. But when Goldwater is doing that, he's using humor as in a way to sort of express humility. Like, he's sort of poking fun at himself by way of poking fun at the part of the country that he's from.
Right.
And when Trump uses humor in your framing, he's doing it really to build himself up.
Right. And when, I mean, that joke, anyone can laugh at it, right? If you're a MAGA Republican listening to this, if you're a Democrat, progressive, you can laugh at that joke. And he wasn't using humor to alienate people or to divide people. I think that's another element of the trolling aspect of the MAGA coalition, is that, you know, it can be bullying, it can be very divisive. And I think that's like psychologically difficult, because trolling works, right?
Yeah. Well, so Billy, that makes me think about kind of the motivations behind the form of joking that we've been talking about. When Goldwater makes the kind of joke that he made, it's at his own expense. And something you hear often from professional comedians is that they're like, well, I make fun of myself because I'm worried you will. So if I'm doing it, then you can't. But the type of humor that you're talking about, Trump and the Republicans more broadly deploying these days, it's not at Trump's expense.
Sometimes it's at the expense of the constitutional order. I mean, because it's become this logic, I think, for a lot of Republicans, where if the liberals are getting mad, it must be good, right? This must be something good that we're doing. We're provoking a reaction amongst liberals. But I think at the same time, within that coalition, if you look at someone like Steve Bannon, he's not joking, right? He actually does want Trump to run in 2028. He actually did want Trump to try to stay in office after he lost in 2020. So that's where I think it gets dangerous. And that's for me, why I think, you know, let's be serious about this.
Right. People, that's the title of your post. Right. Let's be serious.
Exactly.
Well, I just want to ask you one more question, because I hadn't thought about this until I read your post. And I'm just curious to get your take on it, because there is this idea a lot of times in modern political discourse that Trump sort of invented this way of communicating as president. But there are some people who feel like Trump's origin story as a politician who was, you know, really intent on actually winning. Some people feel like the moment that he decided to do it is the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011, when then-President Obama basically trolled Trump from the podium by making fun of the birther conspiracy that Trump had been advancing. And there's this very famous video clip of Obama making all these jokes at Trump's expense, and the whole room is laughing, and then the camera pans to Trump just like stone-faced sitting there. Yeah. So I wonder what you make of that. I mean, it is very common for the media broadly to ascribe the origins of this to Trump, but do you think it was Obama?
Yeah, that's a great example to bring up about just how humor has been used in this era. And I don't know what Trump is, if that motivated, but he clearly that in that context was Obama releasing his frustrations at having to deal with the constant unfounded birther conspiracy, which I think that's just a raw moment that history will capture, of a snapshot into, I don't know, the weaponization of humor in this era that we're in.
Yeah. Well, Billy Robb is the author of the Cholla Express Substack newsletter, and also, as he mentioned, a teacher of civics. Billy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Every other year, Desert X turns land in the Coachella Valley into a giant art gallery. The fifth edition is taking place through May 11th and includes pieces called The Living Pyramid, The Act of Being Together, and Soul Service Station. The artists come from all over the world, but my next guest hails from closer by. Chinupa Hanska Luger is based in New Mexico. His piece is called Ghost Ride, and GHOST stands for Generative Habitation Operating System Technology. It's a van surrounded by a red net. And when I spoke with Luger recently, I asked what exactly people who go to check out this piece will see.
The audience will experience a van that is a part of a future ancestral technologies projects that I have been doing over, you know, the last 10 years or so, or something like that. It will be a van that is like a nomadic future in which we gently create habitation as we navigate a future landscape.
So is this a van, like, will people be able to go inside of it? Do they just look at it from the outside? Like, how will people interact with this piece?
The piece is going to be all locked up. So it's as though you're entering into somebody else's camp. So there isn't access to the interior of the vehicle, but the exterior of the vehicle is a mirrored surface. So the audience can imagine themselves quite literally projected onto the vehicle itself.
Hmm. Is there something about this particular art exhibition that makes this kind of piece appealing to you? Or, like, was there some thought about, like, this isn't going into an art gallery or a museum, this is going to Desert X, this is maybe the right thing for that?
Yeah, this van project, really, I have done other iterations of this vehicle in the future ancestral technologies kind of scope. And for Desert X, this was the first instance where I got to present the van as a mobile vehicle, whereas in a museum, it has to be drained of fluids and made ready to be exhibited in a museum. So in this instance, we're going to move this vehicle to three locations throughout the duration of Desert X. And the advantage of that was really kind of in response to some of the critiques that I've seen about Desert X as far as the environmental impact on the desert. I thought this way I could limit the impact of audience entering into a site. So by moving it, I hope that it makes it a bit more accessible to a wider range of audience. And also, it's not going to have a 10-week impact on any one location.
Is there something that is appealing to you about being a part of this particular show?
I think the thing that's interesting to me is, really on any exhibition at this point in history, it's important for Indigenous representation in a time of, you know, deep-rooted xenophobia and concerns about our future existence on the planet. I believe Indigenous knowledge is paramount to the survival of our societies. And learning how to look at the land with reverence rather than resource is a component that I'm interested in sharing with as many people as possible. So working with Desert X gives me the opportunity to reach an entire demographic that's experienced the impacts of environmental, you know, collapse I don't even want to say collapse, like the impact of all of the signs of, like, global warming and threats to the impact of our systems on the earth right now. I think it's important to present this work here in California, in a place that's, you know, in close proximity to, you know, these varieties of cityscapes and, you know, places where water is being recognized as a quite valuable resource. The van itself is designed to harvest water from the air. So it is a fog drip or cloud drip mechanism that's a part of this imagined future culture. So that for me is a way to present alternatives to our future. And really just to encourage audiences to imagine something different. Because I think we are inundated with choices, but these choices are limiting the possibilities of what our future can be. And I encourage people that this is not a representation of the future, but a future.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you had something in mind that you hope that viewers of your piece sort of would think about the future. It sounds like you don't. It's more like you just want them to think about the future, whatever that might look like to each individual.
Well, I mean, I would agree with that. I think it's important that we remember that our complexity and our diversity is primarily land-based. So how does culture evolve to adapt to the regions in which it's presented? So this is definitely a desert kind of landscape, and the culture that I'm representing navigate that desert landscape with an emphasis on environmental resilience.
What do you think is the role of art in maybe forcing people or encouraging people to think about stuff like that, especially in a place like you reference in California, a place like Arizona, where it is very hot and water is a scarce resource and there are other sort of environmental challenges? What role does art play in all that, do you think?
Well, I think arts, you know, has greatly been underutilized as a way to make comprehensible nearly incomprehensible things. So the advantage of art is that it speaks in a visual language versus a written language. So I think as long as art remains within the scope of a commodity, it's really undermining its true power and its true potential. Art is communication.
How much do you find that artists are thinking about the future as opposed to depicting either the past or sort of their present?
You know, art is, it's a time machine, right? Like as we operate with it right now, every artist who's alive today, every contemporary artist, no matter where they're from or what their reach is, are generating work that is a deep time relationship to their ancestors. So like any skill sets that I apply in the present were tips on failing from generations before, you know, like, this is what I've learned. This works. This doesn't work. It's my responsibility in the present to push the edge of that, to make mistakes, but also to generate solutions to problems I didn't even know I had. Now, I make that work in the present, but far into the future, long after I am gone, there will be more people who will experience the object that I generate in the present. And so the physical object of an art piece or some sort of ecstatic expression or a presentation of idea or comprehension of unimaginable data sets, all of these things can be applied in a physical object that actually moves through the space-time continuum. And so the art object for any artist is a time machine, and it is drawing from the past, built in the present to communicate to our future.
That's so interesting. All right, that is artist Chinupa Hanska-Luger. His work will be at Desert X this year. Chinupa, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Take care.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. In her new book, She-Wolves, historian Paulina Brin retells the history of American finance. Long considered a boys' club, Brin reframes the trading floors and conference rooms of Wall Street as a place where women played a consequential role in shaping the best and worst of American financial culture. The origins of the book came when Brin started listening to an oral history of the rise of Wall Street's influence on American life between 1950 and 1980. This collection included 55 of what these historians considered to be the most influential figures in financial history. 50 of those 55 figures were men, which Brin says was disappointing but not surprising. As she told me recently, what surprised her was what the men said in their interviews.
When the men were asked in the interviews about women, sort of where were the women, did you hire women? They would say, oh, there just weren't women around. There just weren't any qualified women. And that's just not true. Yeah. There were so many women around, many of them highly qualified. They were learning on the job, just as the men were in those days.
Tell us what 1960s Wall Street was like.
It was completely different. It was almost a quaint little enclave, quiet little enclave on the tip of Manhattan. Wall Street wasn't really the kind of moneymaker that it became in the 1980s. The telephone was the primary technology. To make a trade, there had to be something like 10 phone calls at least. It was so different. Though, as I described, the printing shops, of course, you know, nobody had Xerox machines. There were printing shops everywhere, all over Wall Street, and they had rooms where you could have drinks for free, and there was a bowling alley in one place. Just a very different world. And these women are entering it, Wall Street, exactly as it's starting to change, and then it just blows up in the 1980s and becomes sort of the epicenter of American values.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk a little bit about the women who laid the groundwork for that transition, because to me, in a lot of ways, part of this book is about the cultural headwinds that women faced in two arenas. One of those being the academy, kind of like the Ivy League business school, hyper-professionally minded sort of person who gets interested in working on Wall Street. But then there are also secretaries and other women, who some of whom actually dropped out of college and didn't have any formal academic training, but had a good set of instincts.
You have all these young, frankly, kind of scrappy young women, most of them college dropouts, not all of them, but many of them college dropouts from the outer boroughs. So not from Manhattan, coming to Wall Street, not wanting to be on Wall Street, but they come because the secretarial pool work pays a bit more on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. They sort of end up there. And some of them start to sort of look around, listen, learn, and they start to climb that ladder. And at the same time, what you have in the 1960s is, I talk about the Harvard Business School. Harvard Business School lets women in officially in 1963. The first 8 women come to Harvard Business School for the full 2-year MBA. They are rather tortured by their male classmates who keep asking, like, why are you here? Are you here to find a husband? Because why else would you be there?
Right.
And they don't do as well coming out of business school. Having an MBA from Harvard Business School turns out to be a worse pathway than being a secretary from Brooklyn.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah. And there's another layer to that that you get into that I think is extremely interesting, which is that most readers, I think, could probably predict, not that it's not interesting, that there would be clashes between the men in the finance world and the women entering the finance world. But one of the things that you get into in the book is that there was actually a cultural clash between these two different groups of women in the finance world, the ones who came in through this academic track versus the ones who climbed their way up through the secretariat pool.
And then there's another clash with these early pioneering women and then the droves of women coming in the early 1980s who are truly armed with Ivy League degrees and MBAs, and those things count at that point.
We've already talked about so many of the incredibly complex dynamics here, and we haven't even talked about, you know, nobody in our conversation so far has executed a single trade.
Even as women, as these secretaries start to climb the ladder, the first place to go if you're trying to climb that ladder, for the most part, is research analysis. It was nerdy, it was seen as feminized, therefore women were allowed in. And when you wrote these reports as a research analyst, you could sign off with initials. You didn't have to put your full name. So that was a great place for women to hide.
Yeah.
As they're rising in the ranks, and often men wouldn't know for years that they've been recommending stocks recommended by women.
Wow.
They still couldn't trade. They still couldn't trade. That was the big barrier, ultimately.
Right. This is also a broader portrait of just how twisted and warped Wall Street culture writ large is, and how, broadly speaking, resistant to change and transformation it's been relative to other industries. Something I heard you say in an interview once is that you said something to the effect of, if you notice, there was never a Me Too reckoning on Wall Street.
You know, Wall Street is a very secretive place. Women will often not talk about mm-hmm. what they experienced.
Yeah.
So part of the challenge was also finding women who would talk.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the women said, especially from, I'd say, 60s and 70s, was that the worst was not the touching and the sort of the unfairness of it all, but the fact that often, especially when they were finally in a position where they were brokers or traders, that often men wouldn't speak to them. In other words, this was their job. They needed to be in communication to make deals. And some men just wouldn't talk to them. They'd have their clerks sort of be intermediaries, like it was a divorced couple that couldn't talk to each other. And it's been really interesting because as I'm doing a lot of book events and so forth, I just did one last night at UBS, the bank, a huge turnout. And what was great, it was a lot of young women. And I was chatting with some of them after as I was signing books, and I was asking them, of course, like, how's the experience now? And indeed, so many of them said, well, it's improved. But just the other night, I was at a business dinner, and I was the only woman at this enormous table, and it happens all the time. Another one this morning, prepping for another event, and again, a woman who's 40 has two small kids, and she said that all of these issues that I talk about in the book, I mean, in a different fashion, I'm certainly diluted, but so much of that is still there.
Yeah. Well, Paulina Brenn is the author of the book She-Wolves and also a professor of history at Vassar College. Paulina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. A new documentary profiles Indigenous architects and how they incorporate their communities into their designs. There will be a screening of From Earth to Sky at ASU later today. One of the architects featured in the film is Wanda Della Costa. She's a member of the Saddle Lake Cree Nation in Alberta, Canada, and director and founder of the Indigenous Design Collaborative at ASU. I spoke with her earlier, and we started our conversation by talking about how she first got interested in architecture and realized it was something she could pursue as a career.
Well, it was a roundabout route. I know a lot of people talk about, you know, share the story that they've always dreamed of being an architect since they were little. That was not the case. I did have a handy father who was nailing things and reconstructing things on our property, and that was helpful. But what I did is after I finished my undergrad, I had heard when I was working, you know, I was at 14, 15, and I heard someone talking about doing a backpacking adventure around the world. And I was very intrigued. No one from where I grew up, you know, I'm first generation to university. No one from where I grew up was going on a backpacking trip around the world. I listened very intently to these two girls with their Lonely Planet guides heading to Australia. And a couple of years after, I saved enough money after I finished my undergraduate degree and went traveling. And it was through that trip, which lasted, it was supposed to be 6 months. It lasted 7 years. And through that journey, I realized that I was really drawn to urban spaces, buildings, public spaces, and really, you know, looking at my roots back home. You know, my grandmother and my mother grew up on a reservation or reserve up in Canada, and just seeing that disconnect between people and their environments. And I didn't see that disconnect while I was overseas. And so that's what gave me the idea, well, could I reconnect culture and the built environment?
That's really interesting. I mean, how much do you try to think about those kinds of things? Like, how much do you think about, for example, your mother and grandmother and where they grew up and the lives that they led as you are designing buildings in more urban spaces?
I mean, I think it's innate in this profession because all of those early experiences that we have as architects impact the way we look through this lens of architecture and create these spaces.
So how do those experiences manifest themselves in your designs now?
Well, I think, you know, the love of open space, nature, and of course, you know, that Indigenous people have a kinship relationship with nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about Father Sky, Mother Earth, Grandfather Moon, Sun. There's a lot of kinship terms in our natural environment. And so I think part of the foundation of how we create design is that alignment with place, with sun, with climate, with the materials of a place, with the history of a place. And I think that's how it impacts it. And it's, I guess, instructive to our practice so much that we've actually created something called the Indigenous Placekeeping Framework. And it's a methodology that we use to allow people to get closer to what that context is, what that history is of these wonderful spaces and places that exist throughout the world.
Are those kinds of ideas unique to Indigenous architects, do you think? Or are they things that architects in general are thinking about?
I think there's a transformation happening right now. You know, for those listeners that study or are interested in architecture, there was a big movement it started about, I don't know, 70 years ago called modernism. And that movement was about creating almost a homogenous design aesthetic that was originating in Europe. And it was very modern, you know, very clean lines and kind of white boxes. And that was the era that I was educated in architecture school, which of course doesn't fly. Those buildings don't relate to many places in the world, but that's what we were being taught. And so I think right now there's a shift in the field where we realize, okay, that was a fun, it was a fad, it was a moment in time in the field of architecture, but there are other ways to imagine spaces. And I think if we can attune more to the people, the place, the climate, I think this would do us all well, if for survival on this planet. And so I think the movement is coming. It's called human-centered design is one aspect that I think Indigenous design falls really well within, you know, because we're using the human as the main purpose. It's not about winning an award. It's not about getting into the magazines. It's really about making sure these spaces are conducive to the people who will occupy them eventually. There's also a big push to ecological design right now. And again, Indigenous design is a really beautiful lens because of this kinship relationship.
It kind of sounds like what you're describing is what we hear a lot of architects talking about in terms of especially trying to deal with things like climate change, especially, you know, in a place like the Phoenix area where it's increasingly getting warmer. How can we use design? How can we use architecture to make buildings more resilient and maybe bring down cooling costs and make things more comfortable for the people living or working inside those buildings? It sounds very much like what you were just describing.
Absolutely. And we've actually worked with a local tribe here in Arizona, the Gila River Indian community. And you're absolutely right. It was eye-opening. We went and studied their traditional architecture, and they don't just have one type of building. You know, I come from, I'm Plains Cree, so we come from we're teepee builders. But the Gila River people don't have just a singular type of building that they lived in this climate that, you know, goes from very large extremes from winter to summer. And so we studied about 15 different prototypes that they had. And so I do think that the traditional building techniques of, this region, and I'm guessing if we did research in all the other regions, would have lessons for all architects.
Yeah. So you mentioned that when you were a child, architecture wasn't really on your radar. I'm wondering how much of that had to do with the fact that there weren't many people who maybe came from where you came from and had your background and maybe looked like you who were doing that kind of job.
That is absolutely right. We had social workers. We had teachers, as an example. My mother was a cultural instructor. So when kids come into the city and they are losing their culture because of the move to the city, she would help bring culture back into the classroom for the kids. She wasn't a trained teacher, but she was more of a cultural instructor. And really, those are the role models that we had. That was it. So it is really hard to imagine becoming something when you don't have any examples around you.
Well, so given that, how important is it to you that now you are doing this job to try to make it so that children, you know, from your community with similar backgrounds to you, see that you are doing this and succeeding at it and that this is a viable option?
Absolutely. It's a big part of our work. So, and particularly in my teaching, the teaching part of my day, We have changed the curriculum at ASU to make it more meaningful for students, for young Indigenous students, in the hope that they will choose the profession. And of course, me standing up in front of sitting at the podium, it changes the dynamics because those kids will say, you know what, I can do this too. She did it. And I would say that I'm not alone.
Wanda Dalla Costa is an architect with the firm Towau Architecture Collaborative. She's also director and founder of the Indigenous Design Collaborative at ASU.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.